Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 68 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. My guest today was last here 40 episodes ago, and that time around, she was actually doing me a great service by filling in, since I had asked 8 different people if they wanted to watch Beautiful, and none of them wanted to, and then my guest and I saw Beautiful, and we could pretty much figure out why. But this time, I made a better effort to specifically invite this guest, and also a specific effort to choose a better film. So I'm hoping that everything is great today. Everything was great last time, so I expect more of the same. She is a contributor on row3.com, and she also runs her own site, The Frame, which you can find at the-frame.com. My guest is across the wire from Los Angeles, California tonight. It is Jandy Stone Hardesty. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, Ryan. How are you?
I am not bad. I think the TIFF come down has officially sunk in. The tunnel vision is clearing. My attention span is growing, and sleep is slowly returning. So I think I'm over the hump.
Well, there you go. You've started eating full meals again.
Yes. Yeah. You know, not just tea and Hot Pockets. I'm on to like 3 squares. It's great. If you want to learn more details about Jandy and the recording of episode 68, check out the Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today being Monday, September 24th, or by searching #MATM68. On episode 68, we'll be discussing The Master. We'll be finding out about people's cinematic bucket list and turn the record over to play the other side. Before that, we need to learn a little bit more about Jandy. This is Know Your Enemy. So back on episode 28, we learned that the first film Jandy had seen was Pinocchio. The last film she'd seen at the time was The Black Pirate. That's a silent film starring Douglas Fairbanks. The worst films she'd seen, she double-dipped, was the 1998 version of The Avengers. That's not the Marvel film. That's the crappy TV adaptation with Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman. She also paired that up with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I just realized that Sean Connery's in both.
Yeah, I realized that later, too.
Wow, that was...
He started making some poor decisions at some point.
Yes, he did. That's for damn sure. The classic that she had yet to see at the time was Apocalypse Now. Any luck on that?
Yes, I have seen it now.
Did you actually see both versions? Did you see the original and then the Redux?
I have still only seen the original version.
Which is fine, because the Redux, I think, is kind of a different monster. But how'd you like the original?
You know, it's been months now since I've seen it, and I'm still not sure. Like, it was a lot different than I expected. So okay. I think, like, my expectations of it kind of played into...
Interesting.
So my feeling kind of lost when I actually watched it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm definitely planning to go back and watch the Redux version, too, and then maybe I'll kind of get it clear in my head.
I'll be curious to see how you react to that. And, of course, the film that she wished she had made was Bonnie and Clyde, just because it was so damn perfect she wished she could put her name on it. So we have the second round of questions. Jandy, what is a film that you like that nobody else does?
Well, my go-to answer on this question is Speed Racer, the Wachowski Speed Racer. and it does have a lot of defenders in certain circles, particularly around Row 3, so I feel comfortable there. But... yeah, a lot of people really hate that movie. I don't know how you feel about it.
I like it, but it was... when I saw it, first of all, I saw it at a screening series that was called Defending the Indefensible, where I expected it to be crap. Like, I've seen some pretty crappy movies in that series. Also, by that time, like, I saw this not this past spring, but the spring before, so like spring of 2011. So 3 or 4 years had gone by since it was released. So I had, like, fully braced myself with all of the stories and everything like that. And it was kind of in that time becoming this... pseudo cult classic. So I didn't mind it. I actually kind of like it, and I think it's a film that's really suited well for Blu-ray. So I kind of wonder why I don't have a copy already.
Yeah, that's actually how I saw it the first time. I didn't see it in the theaters because, like, the reviews came out and they were terrible, and I decided to go see Indiana Jones 4 instead. That was a mistake. Yeah, I saw it on Blu-ray later, and I just was blown away. Like, I sat about 5 feet away from my TV just with my jaw dropped the whole time.
Now, is there anything in particular about it that you're really affectionate about the film? Like, anything that you really kind of find yourself drawn to?
Well, I mean, it's the visual style of it that gets me. I will forgive a lot of faults in screenplay and acting and stuff if the visual style is intriguing enough, and I just thought it was amazing.
What's a film that everybody else seems to like but you don't?
So I guess since we're talking about the master, mentioning There Will Be Blood is a little too obvious.
Yeah.
But that would definitely be one. But I have others as well.
Okay.
Another one that I really don't like that everyone else does is Knocked Up. The Judd Apatow film?
Really?
Yeah. I hate that film. Like, I can't stand it.
Now, is that just a case of, you know, like, comedy, of course, is subjective. There's tons of movies that everybody else thinks is really hysterical that I don't. Is it just that, or is there more to it that besides the fact that you just don't find it funny?
Well, I don't find it funny, so that is a big part of it. But I just, like, I don't really like Apatow in general. There's not very many of his films that I care for, but this one in particular seems to kind of try to appeal to a wide range of people, both men and women. And I feel like the women characters in it are written so poorly that I don't understand why it's embraced the way that it is.
You know what? I hadn't really thought of that before, because you've got you've got the Leslie Mann character as well, who's actually really Sorry.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, please. she's really abrasive in this movie, and it's you got to wonder why.
Yeah, she is. I actually, the Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd storyline, I do actually like. That doesn't mean I'm going to go see This Is 40, because it's like, it takes all the things that I didn't like about Knocked Up and puts them in the Leslie Mann, Paul Rudd story. But I like their subplot, but the main plot, especially the way Allison was written, Katherine Heigl's character, I just didn't believe any of the decisions that she made. Like, they weren't consistent with her character I set out in the beginning.
Yeah, and I guess, like, kind of the dopey stoner humor, like the kind of the schlubby humor of it all, it just also that wasn't landing for you at all, like, which of course would make matters worse.
No, it works for me at all.
Yeah.
It's not my thing.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of funny. You mentioned, just while we're on the topic, you mentioned Apatow. Where did you come down on Freaks and Geeks?
I do like Freaks and Geeks. That's the one property of his that I actually like. There are a few of his movies I can put up with. Like, for some reason, I can put up with Forgetting Sarah Marshall. But there's not really any of his movies that I really like, even the things that he's produced.
Well, I enjoy it. I laughed at it. I found it funny. It's nothing that I'd put up there in, like, my top 20 or anything like that. But, yeah, you know what? It's the one thing that you kind of tap on there that makes total sense is anytime there's a comedy that everybody else says is so funny and you just watch it and sigh, that's such a friggin' chore. What was the last film to make you cry?
I rewatched West Side Story last week for the gazillionth time.
Aww.
And yeah, I pretty much cry through, like, the whole second half of that movie.
You know, the one thing it's sort of a phenomenon that occurs to me. There's one film that can do it, but I'm always sort of caught off guard. First of all, when people watch films like they've seen before and it still makes them cry. Cause as I said, there's not very many that can do that for me. But also just a story like that, that's so famous.
Yeah, but it's how it's done and it's the music and it's like the way the characters interact. And it's just,
is there any moment in particular that really puts you over the edge, or is it the end?
Well, I think, have you seen the movie?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I think, what got me this time was the song, like, after they've had the rumble, and Anita comes back and talks to Maria,
yep,
and, like, realizes that even though Maria's boyfriend killed her boyfriend, that Maria's love for him is still real, and that's something important to her. And I think that moment of connection between Anita and Maria, it was what started it this time.
Oh, man, now you're getting me, Misty. See, like, I here's me making fun of you for crying at, you know, the musical Romeo and Juliet, and I'm weeping up here. Okay, I won't mock you too much for that. So I'll let that one slide. In the movie of your life, who plays you?
You know, I hear you ask this question of like every time a guest is on for the second time, and I'm always like, I have no idea how I'll answer that question for my turn again. But I decided I would go with Emma Stone, actually, as a slightly younger me, but still.
Okay, and why Emma Stone?
Like, I really like her, and she and I share, at least in her movies, like in the roles that she's played, we have kind of similar sense of humor. Like, that sarcastic edge that she has is exactly the way I was when I was her age.
Okay.
So, yeah, plus I can pretend that she's actually my relative, because Stone.
That's a good point. I don't know why I didn't think of that before. That's a good choice. Actually, she's I think I've said this before on the show, but if not, I'm saying it now. She's one of the actors in Hollywood right now that I will go see a movie just because she's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is strange. Like, I have no idea when that started, certainly after The Rocker. It was just kind of out of nowhere. Like, all of a sudden, I was like, shit, she makes some good movies. So that would be a good one. She's got, like, it's kind of strange. I like her voice as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of strange. Like, I know Scarlett Johansson, like, takes constant crap for her voice, because they both have that kind of deeper, almost like smoker's voice. For all I know, they both smoke. But it, like, I don't know why. For some reason, on Emma Stone, I like it a little bit more.
Well, because I think she's got that, like I said, that sarcastic edge to it, that kind of...
That really, like, dry humor.
Yeah, exactly. So you feel like that's kind of part of her voice tone as well. I don't know, it just kind of all adds together.
Yeah, no, that's a great choice. Hey, listen, if you've had this long to think about it, and that's what you came up with, well done. Last but not least, what's a film that you're going to be watching next?
Well, if you count any films, then I'll probably be watching a whole bunch of Looney Tunes next, because it's Chuck Jones's 100th birthday tomorrow.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I will probably be celebrating in my own way for that, and I'm planning a post for Row 3, my first in a long time, so hopefully I'll get that done. But in terms of future films, probably the new Resident Evil movie we'll see on Saturday.
I think you're going to be doing better off with the Chuck Jones.
I don't know. I love my Mila Jovovich.
Oh, boy. The thing is, like, the running joke, of course, is that the Resident Evil franchise has kept much of the Toronto film industry in work for the last decade, because they know that every 2 years there's going to be another project to work on. Remind me, because you will know this, which film was it? Was it Vertigo that Chuck Jones did the sequence in the middle? There's the moment where Scotty's doing is having his nightmare, and there's sort of like some animation to it. Wasn't that Chuck Jones, or am I imagining things?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that it is, but I don't know that it isn't.
Oh, okay. I thought you would have schooled me on that one.
I think.
Because I was going to say, you could kind of cap, if it is, I could swear that that's what it is, and or, you know, it could be a moment right now where I'm getting it wrong, and I've got people screaming into their headphones. But if it is Chuck Jones, then there you go. You could, like, watch some Looney Tunes and end it all off with Vertigo, because that would work out pretty well.
That would definitely be a good day of movie watching.
There we go. Well, Resident Evil, Vertigo, and Chuck Jones. I cannot think of a better day. So there we go. That is more about Jandy Stone Hardesty. And it's time that we need to hear about you fine folks. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Come Talk to Me. Come talk to me. So, in amongst all of my TIFF episodes, and I do thank you if you listen to any or all of my Wicked Little Town dispatches. They were a lot of fun to record, and I know that they might have seemed a little bit of a test, because of course we're talking about films that many of you folks haven't seen, but I do thank you if you listen to even just a few minutes. In amongst all of that, I dropped the new feedback question, which was, as a moviegoer, what's on your bucket list? What's a cinematic experience that you would like to have that you have not yet had? And I got a lot of answers, so bear with us here. David Brooke, somewhat of a new listener to the show, he's on Blueprint Review in England, said, I'm desperate to see Once Upon a Time in the West on the big screen. A high-quality true print, of course, although an awesome 4K remaster would probably suffice. Well, that's very good of you, David. He says, I get over to Cannes regularly now, but I'd love to see some of the other big festivals. Sundance would be great, and all you guys over in Canada make me very jealous whenever TIFF is in town. He also says, I'd love to see something at Man's Chinese Theater too, just to say I've done it. What is Man's like? Have you ever been there?
Yes, I have. It's magnificent.
Oh, huh, okay.
Definitely a good bucket list item.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, it's certainly on mine. I think if you're a movie lover, it has to be, but part of me in the back of my head thought, you know, what if it's a dive?
No, it's amazing. It's probably not the biggest, short of IMAX screens, it's probably as big as some IMAX screens in terms of width, but I mean, not height. But yeah, it's amazing. It holds 1,100 people, and even if you're way in the back, like, you know, screen, I mean, the screen
still fills your vision.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Cool. Well, there we go. Eric from The Warning Sign in Chicago, he has three. He says, one, see 2001 A Space Odyssey on the big screen. Two, attend a major film festival, maybe TIFF. Three, a smaller dream of mine is to catch a midnight screening of They Live, which I will be eagerly doing next month. Between that and RoboCop, The Music Box knows how to win over my heart. Eric was one of the ones, when I went to Chicago this summer, we all went to the midnight screening of RoboCop there at The Music Box. So knowing that they're going to be showing They Live in that is pretty cool. That's some great stuff, Eric. I have done the first two on your bucket list, and I can tell you that they are pretty damn cool. So hopefully you do get a chance to check all that out. A new listener / follower of the site, Andina from Inspired Ground in Indonesia. My net is expanding, it would seem. Said, my movie going bucket list number one would be to attend a great film festival. There was one great international in Indonesia, but unfortunately they were short on funds, so it's not around anymore. There are some mini film festivals that seem great, but she wants to take in a larger one. Nick from Cinema Romantico, also in Chicago, said there's an annual outdoor screening of Last of the Mohicans in the mountains of North Carolina where it was filmed, and I would love to someday attend that. Did you know that? That was news to me.
I've never heard of that. That sounds amazing, though.
I suddenly feel the great, like, I do love that film, and I suddenly feel the urge to check that out. You might be able to scratch off Nick's second one. He says, to have and have not on the big screen, anytime, anywhere. If I could just once hear Bogey and Bacall's repartee echoing through a theater, oh, heaven help me. Have you seen that one on a big screen?
I have not seen that one. I don't think I've seen any of their four collaborations. Oh, okay. On a big screen. I would pick the big screen over to have and have not, but for that scene, he's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I should apologize in advance to anybody who wrote in. Jandy and I are not trying to boast, but it's just, you know, it's just the natural response of what we have and have not done. And we both realize we're very, very lucky to live where we are and have the lifestyle that affords us this to be able to do these things for now. Jessica from the Velvet Cafe in Sweden said, TIFF is definitely on my bucket list. While I admittedly never have considered attending either of the big Swedish film festivals, Stockholm and Gothenburg, I would love to go to Canada, not as much for the films as for the opportunity to meet the bunch of us here. We seem to have a blast, and of course she wants to know all the activities around the film, such as Q&As while with attending directors. On Twitter, Corey Atad said, the DeLorean takes me back in time for premieres of The Wizard of Oz, Psycho, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Back to the Future. And when I told Corey what he would like to do on his bucket list in reality, first of all, he chided me for not thinking fourth dimensionally. And then said he would like to see a screening of Close Encounters with Steven Spielberg present to do an extended Q&A. That would be cinematic heaven for me. Well, Corey, we agree, which is rare for Corey and I. But yeah, I hear about these every once in a while where Spielberg does an event. He really doesn't do them often, but every once in a while, I think the last time I heard something like this, he presented the 4K showing of Raiders of the Lost Ark. But because he's so busy and he's my number one filmmaker with a bullet, he's the kind of person who I would love to be in the audience and just listen to him speak about anything, really.
Yeah, that would definitely be an experience to have. Yeah. Even here, he doesn't really. I mean, a lot of people do come and do stuff at the American Cinematheque, but I can't remember a time that he has, except maybe the Raiders thing.
He's too busy, is what it is. He makes Joss Whedon look like a slacker.
Yeah, it's not that he wouldn't, I don't think. It's just that he's probably never in town, actually, if he's not working.
Andrew Kendall, Andreas, and Rich Watson all had the same thing on their bucket list. They all want to go to Cannes and hear. Nick Hath from Dubai said, I want to go to some special Harry Potter screening where they show us all the films, and hopefully the cast would be there. She apologizes for being such a dork. However, Nick, I would put out to you that you're not that much of a dork, because I can think of at least a dozen people who would jump at just that opportunity. Sam Akosh from Sydney, Australia, also mentioned attending TIFF. She actually hopes to do that next year. And Sam, we would all love to have you here. She also brings up Telluride Film Festival, which would be great. And finally, she says she'd like a Miyazaki marathon with the director in attendance. Somewhat of a high hope, I think.
I think that would be.
Just a bit.
You never know.
Yeah, the stranger things have happened. I love this answer. Will Malone wants to run a small movie theater, and he says, I want to turn creative control of one screen over to the public. People would suggest films, and then we'd run them for a week. He does admit that they may need some quality control, but that would be awesome. I think that would be a little bit more of a democratic way, rather than saying this is what we're bringing in because this is what people see. Maybe you can have a little bit more of a understanding of what your community wants to see.
Yeah, that would be cool. I think the harder thing than the scheduling and dealing with the quality control would be getting the prints that you would need for that. But
yeah. Last Twitter recommendation came from Alex Hulse, who I met for the first time at TIFF after following him on Twitter for quite some time. He said, based on all the gushing around Twitter these days, apparently going to Fantastic Fest would fit the bill. And I agree. There's a bunch of people who I met last week who were all basically headed straight to Fantastic Fest the moment TIFF was over, and they had my jealousy. A few more answers from Facebook. Michael Mendez in Los Angeles said that he'd like to see the Rolling Stones documentary Cocksucker Blues. It's only allowed to be screened about once a year, and the director must be present, so it's a rarity to actually see it. Simon Collum from London said his bucket list is to be sent to L.A. or Cannes on business, coverage of the set, interviewing with the cast, to record a commentary or present a screening. He would just love to be dispatched. Sebastian Gutierrez also said TIFF. He said TIFF all the way, even more than Cannes, though I wouldn't say no to that. And last but not least, Aiden Redmond from Cut the Crap Movie Reviews said Rocky Horror Picture Show. I really need to grow a pair, dress the part, and see it live. Which I never have. Have you? That's the kind of thing that happens monthly around here. Have you ever taken part in one of those?
I haven't, but it happens almost weekly here.
Exactly, right?
It's not for lack of opportunity.
I think that might be what I have to do on Halloween this year.
There you go.
And so I'll do that. Maybe I'll dress up as Brad or something. That's quite a range there. Do you have one or in particular or two in particular that are on your bucket list?
Of course. Yeah. Most of them are festivals because, Toronto, I get a lot of opportunities for individual screenings here. But TIFF is obviously one. And like Jessica said, as much for meeting everyone that's up there as it is for the festival itself. But instead of Cannes, I would actually choose the Venice Film Festival. I would really, really like to go to Venice for that.
They tend to bring in some cool stuff. That's what I like about Venice.
I've been to Venice one time, and it's gorgeous. Like, it was my favorite city that we went to in Italy, and I would just love to see a film festival in that environment. And it's also the oldest continuing film festival. Like, it started in 1932, I was looking up today.
Wow.
So, yeah, like, I like that sense of history. And then probably a little bit more possible for me, or at least in the shorter term possible, is I'd like to go up to San Francisco Silent Film Festival and have that every year, and I would love to attend that.
Very cool, very cool. Correct me if I'm wrong, Venice isn't, like, geographically, Venice isn't very big either, is it?
It's not that big, no.
So that would be...
It's really compact.
Yeah, that would be very, very cool. I hadn't thought of that one, and I don't know why. And certainly going to San Francisco, our mutual blogging friend Mariah Gates always makes me very jealous because she takes pictures of the marquee at the Castro and like what they're showing as double features. And it's not even like, first of all, it's not like I don't have access to these films on Blu-ray, and it's not like I don't have access to theaters that would show these kinds of things. But just knowing that she's seeing, you know, these two particular films back to back in this great little theater, every picture that she sends, I just kind of silently seethe.
Yeah, and they program really well at that theater too. Yeah. So,
did you ever get up there for, I'm guessing the answer is no. Did you get up there for Napoleon last year?
No, I didn't. Mm. That would have been great.
yeah, that's for damn sure. Well, mine, I've got two, and they're two different things. One is I feel the urge to go to the Alamo Draft House in Austin. I kind of feel like for what we do, Austin is kind of the mothership, and I feel like you, if as a movie geek, you have to go there at some point in your life.
I agree. You should definitely do that.
Yeah. So there's that, and I know that Draft House has started branching out. Like, I think they've got one in New York, and there's a quiet rumor that there might be one in Toronto eventually, but that's not the same for me. And it also just being able to take in like festivals that they do down there, like South by Southwest and that kind of thing. So going A to Austin, Texas, B to the Alamo Draft House is high up there for me. The other one, which didn't really hit my radar until this past summer, really. And this is one, it's kind of counter everybody saying how I want to go to TIFF, is I actually want to go to TCM Fest.
You should. That would be awesome.
Because, well, first of all, you know, I kind of saw how much fun y'all were having last spring because Titania locally went down there. Did you meet her when she was down there?
Yeah.
So Titania went down there and the Mariah, who we were just talking about a second ago, went, and these and you go, of course. And you know, and I always kind of talk with all you guys about all sorts of classic films. So there's that as a number one. Number two, really in the last year, I've actually kind of taken more of an affection to TCM. Like, I kind of sit down every Monday and see what's playing, and like my PVR is full of all these classic films. And it's really kind of jacked my passion for that kind of filmmaking. So having just a week of it, of not even really worrying about the thing about a film festival, of course, is you don't know what you're getting into when you don't have all the details. But knowing about these films a little bit more and being able to make a little bit of more informed choice would be very, very cool. So that's the other one for me, is I'm actually hoping, if not next year, that the year after, that I actually do make it to TCM Fest, if only for a few days.
Well, it's only 3 days long, so it's
There we go.
It's a Thursday night when they do like a big premiere of some new big restoration. And Friday, all day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So it's not a full week.
Well, there we go. Those are some definitely like some great bucket list choices. Some stuff Jandy and I have done, some stuff we've never done, some stuff that we want to do. Really, really cool stuff. So thanks everybody for writing in this first episode back after my film festival experience. For the next episode, episode 69 will be the Thanksgiving episode. We celebrate it earlier here in Canada than everybody does down in the States. And I want to know something in your movie-going life that you are thankful for this year. It can be, you can take that however you wish. Something you're thankful for, movie-related, let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook. You can leave a comment on the blog. I'd love to know for the next episode. That'll take us to the review for this episode, The New Slang. And the movie in The New Slang is Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. Thank you. The Master is written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. It stars Joaquin Phoenix, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Amy Adams, amongst a few others. The story of The Master is that of Freddie Quell. He is an ex-Navy officer. No, not an officer. He's an ex-sailor who returns from World War II just basically a mess of a man. Through a weird little circumstance, he runs into something of a guru to his followers. They, at first, we only know him as the Master. He does have a name. His name is Lancaster Dodd. And he is, he's spearheading a new movement, which we only hear is the Cause. And, Freddie gets drawn into this lifestyle, this possibly a cult. And, we try to follow and see if it'll actually make him a better person. Jandy, you saw this last week, so did I. I think we saw it around the same day, actually. What did you think of The Master?
Well, I actually ended up liking it quite a bit. I went in, you know, a little bit apprehensive based on my experience with There Will Be Blood, which I didn't like. But I liked the previews for this one, and so when you brought it up for the matinee cast, I was like, yeah, I would like to see that. I'm curious to see what it's like. And I ended up enjoying it quite a bit.
Yeah, to kind of set the scene, this was the last film I saw at the film festival last week, and as much as I did enjoy it, I will say this, if you've seen 26 films in 10 days, ending with The Master or anything of its ilk is not a good idea, because it was just, it's something very heavy to carry on your shoulders after sensory overload. I did like it quite a bit. I found it very, very, I'm going to use the word dense, but that's not to say that it's complicated, because it's really not. But I just found it a very, very heavy movie that I can tell you right this second, I want to watch again. I took, during a film festival, I take notes, because otherwise I'm not going to remember squat by the time the movie's done. And I took just pages and pages of notes on this one. And still, I came away from it thinking, I think I missed a few things just because I didn't really know what to make of it.
I can understand that reaction. I think it's a little bit enigmatic and maybe ambiguous on purpose.
Yeah. I hate to say this because it sounds terrible, but not a whole lot happens in this movie. You know, we find out that Freddy is screwed up. We watch him meet the Master and everybody else in the Cause, and then they kind of screw with his head, and we kind of see what happens in the Cause. But that, you know, I've just described it in about three sentences, but it goes on for 2 hours and 20 minutes. So we're watching all these individual interactions and character moments. There's not a whole lot of story, if that makes any sense.
No, it's a very interior kind of character study.
Yeah,
type
thank
of,
you. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for there. The good thing, though, is that I found it very grand and intimate at the same time. There's a lot of moments where the camera pulls back and gives us a lot to look at. There's kind of a cool scene, actually, where this model is walking around a department store. Like a Bloomingdale's or a Hudson's Bay Company, if you're here in Canada. She's walking around the sales floor. It almost seems like something out of Mad Men. But it's so you get moments like that where the camera pulls back and shows you a lot of people and a lot of set and a lot of, you know, details in there. But at the same time, it's also, as I said, it's also very one-on-one. There's a lot of scenes where the camera is really tight in on two or three or four people. And I can't think of too many movies that have done that.
That one or two people focus it's even more so because the plane of focus is so shallow.
Yeah, there's that. We're going to get to that because we both got the chance to see this in kind of a special presentation, but we'll get to that. Now, front and center in this movie, of course, is the acting of Joaquin Phoenix, which, welcome back, Mrs. Sir. It's somebody who we were kind of all writing off just 2 years ago. To return in this way is certainly unexpected. And Phil Seymour Hoffman, who I think can do no wrong. Was there anything about either one of their performances that stuck out for you, or that just really caught you, or did you even like both of them?
I did like both of them, and yeah, obviously, well, maybe obviously, Joaquin Phoenix is more of, it's the more front and center performance, it's the more showy one, but the way that the two performances, like Joaquin Phoenix is just really kind of, he's like angry all the time, even though he doesn't show it, it's like inside him. Like, and the way that plays off of Philip Seymour Hoffman's just stillness and calm, I thought was really great all the way through.
The other thing about Phoenix is he's doing something curious. I don't quite know why he's doing it, but he's kind of like, he keeps his face kind of gnarled up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost like Popeye, and I wasn't quite sure why, like, what in the character had him like that. Like, it's, you know, if you didn't know better, you'd think he'd had a stroke.
Well, I thought that it might have been, like, a war wound or something that we weren't told about.
Yeah, that's possible. I hadn't really thought of that. And then, of course, we've got Phil Seymour Hoffman, who, the Master is a guy who is supposed to be able to win you over just by talking. And if there is any actor in Hollywood who can win you over just by talking, it's Phil Seymour Hoffman. We listen to him argue. We listen to him not mediate. We listen to him almost preach. We listen to him plead his case. And every time he'll throw something different at you and just dare you to look away.
I have a feeling that on rewatch that the Hoffman's performance, like the subtlety and the nuances in Hoffman's performance, will probably stand out even more.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. So. Yeah. He brings a lot of different things, you know, like he brings a lot of anger. There's moments where he brings a calmness. Their last conversation together is just a killer. It's in this gigantic room, and Hoffman just basically lays the smack down on him without ever raising his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'll not be able to stop thinking about that. Now, we did mention the plane of focus. So you and I both saw this film in a 70 millimeter presentation. Why don't you kind of tell people a little bit about what that is and what that means for seeing a film in 70 mil?
Well, I haven't seen a whole lot in 70 mil, but
no,
I mean, it's
me
a bigger format.
Yeah, me neither.
Like, generally, it was interesting seeing this one in 70 mil because usually you think about 70 mil as being, like, an epic format, like, you know, well, like your Lawrence of Arabia or 2001 or something that's really big visually. And, like, you mentioned a scene or two where this does that, but most of the time this is really close, really shallow focus. It works. Like, the bigger format just kind of gives, like, that extra bit of clarity and just closeness. We were sitting really close, too. We were in, like, the second row. But in ArcLight, that's a long way away from the screen. But it was still really close.
Yeah. I was sitting further back. Where I really noticed it was actually right off the opening scene, because we begin with Freddie in one of these military vessels, and he's wearing, you know, a World War II army helmet, and you can see, like, every dimple in the pebbling on the top of that helmet. You know, it's so friggin' clear. And basically the hitch to it is that if you imagine your average piece of film, a 35 millimeter piece of film, a 70 millimeter piece of film is twice as big. A bigger surface means you can record more detail. If you can imagine somebody handing you a piece of paper that's 1 inch by 1 inch and telling you, draw me a house, you're going to draw this little crappy little thumbnail sketch. If they hand you a piece that's 8 by 8.5 by 11, you can record a lot more detail because you have a larger surface to record on. And that's the thing. So the 70 millimeter print, it's kind of making its way around North America and the world, really. It doesn't have a whole lot of play, just mostly because there's not a whole lot of theaters that can show it. But if you have the opportunity, if people who are listening are interested in seeing The Master and they have a 70 millimeter presentation nearby, I would say it's worth the possibly the extra loot, but certainly worth the drive.
70 millimeter often is a wider, like, they use it for widescreen formats.
Yeah.
And this is still 1.85:1, which is kind of your standard format now. Like, yeah. It's not full frame, but it's not like the super wide CinemaScope style either.
Yeah.
So you have a lot more height to work with than a lot of 70mm films do.
Yeah, in a small way, without the vertigo, it's kind of like what Christopher Nolan was doing with the Dark Knight films in using an IMAX presentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was using it more for the height and the image quality than he was, you know, for anything else. Now, I don't really want to go too far here because it's something that can be a little bit of a delicate topic. But the underlying theme, of course, is that of faith and how tricky a path faith can be. This is very loosely based on the beginnings of Scientology. Whether or not JND or I have opinions on Scientology is not really what we're going to talk about. But the one thing I found that this film said is that when it comes to matters of faith, it chose to proceed with caution. Just because somebody tells you some ideas that make you feel better doesn't necessarily mean that you need to follow them into the breach, if that makes any sense to you.
Well, I actually liked the way he treated the cause in the film in terms of, you know, a pseudo-religious, maybe cult kind of thing, you know, part science and part religion. He pointed out there were some issues that he pointed out with it, as you were saying, of, you know, don't trust it too far. And Dodd's own son was like, he's making this up as he goes along. But there are other people in there that clearly believe in it wholeheartedly. I feel like Amy Adams' character did. Like, she was a true believer.
And she... Talk about a character who you don't expect to go where they go.
She was as creepy as hell.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah.
Even though he kind of points out some of those things, it still feels like he's not being judgmental of either the people that buy into it innocently or... the people who actually are helped by it, even if it's a placebo effect or whatever. He kind of approached it in a way that was both pointing at issues with it, but also not judgmentally.
It's very fair. Like, I can remember probably 2 years ago now, you were on another show and you were talking about Agora, and you brought up how Christians can be portrayed in movies sometimes. And it's getting like that all over, that you know, religion is being used as a label and is basically, in all forms, is becoming a stereotype. And Lord knows that the Master is basically begging for that. But it's, you know, it doesn't sugarcoat it, but at the same time, like you said, I think it's very fair.
Well, that was actually one of my issues, if I could bring up There Will Be Blood just briefly, with There Will Be Blood, is that it was never really, and maybe it would be on rewatch, but it was never really clear to me whether Eli was his name, right? The Thanos mm-hmm. character, whether he was supposed to be like an actual Christian preacher or like some kind of cult figure, and I just felt like he didn't really make, I felt like Anderson didn't really make clear his position in that. And this one I felt a lot better about, honestly, for some reason.
Okay. No, that's a very good point. It's been a while since I've watched There Will Be Blood, but I think it might just be because I've seen it a few more times than you have. I got the impression that Paul Dano, that Eli was a true believer. I never saw him as a snake oil salesman. I just thought that basically his faith is completely tested by Daniel Plainview and just all the games that he plays with him. He sees the weakness in him and he's able to exploit it. And it's something, to kind of bring it back to the Master, it's something that nobody is able to do with Dodd, with the Master, because he just talks such a good game that if he doesn't like the way the conversation is going, he will change the conversation, you know, where matters of faith are concerned, and that's how he manages to end up on top. Really briefly, just because we've been talking about this for a little while, where did this kind of fit into Paul Thomas Anderson's canon for you? Like, is it one of his very best? Is it one that you're not as crazy about, like There Will Be Blood? Is it kind of in the middle?
It actually ranked second for me after Magnolia.
Oh.
But there's a couple in the middle there that I haven't seen for a long time, like Boogie Nights, that might go higher if I rewatch them.
Okay. For me, this is right this moment, it's a little bit lower middle. I'll talk about this again in a second, but I wasn't left as awed by the story as I was by some of his other ones. So I'm a little bit hesitant on it at the moment.
Well, I should probably be clear that I don't really consider myself a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan.
Okay, like, and I do.
Magnolia, but all the rest, like other than Magnolia, I love unequivocally, but all the rest usually kind of leave me with some amount of unease. So
yeah, there we go.
My second favorite is not necessarily saying it's like one of my favorite of all time now.
Gotcha. Okay, so before we wrap up, we of course take a spin through the souvenir stand, and Jandy, if you could take one thing from the master and keep it, what would be your souvenir?
My souvenir is the scene where Dodd and Freddy both get thrown into jail.
Yeah, that is pretty epic, isn't it?
Yes, because it was hilarious and really kind of revealing at the same time.
Yeah, that is an awesome souvenir. Mine is something I actually kind of have taken away from the film. Mine is the score by Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead. Holy crap, is it good. I was curious what he'd do after his wonderful score for There Will Be Blood. Again, we should have just done There Will Be Blood for how much it's come up. I was curious to know what he would do after that. He's awesome score to this film. Download it or get your hands on it if you have the chance. It is wonderful. It's both. He's got some really, really elegant and sweeping numbers. He's got some of those little off-kilter numbers. It's very, very cool.
And to go along with that for a second,
yep.
I loved the mixture of that score, which is often kind of like you said, it's often beautiful, but it's often kind of unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Along with the period songs that Anderson put in, I thought like the combination and the counterpoint of those was really great.
Yeah, like "Get Behind Me, Satan," and that, and like "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree," like those kinds of period songs, basically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great. So we, of course, rate on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So, Jandy Stone Hardesty, what do you give Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master?
Out of 4 stars, I'd give it 3.5.
Yeah, I'm on that as well. I'm kind of in a strange position because, A, at the time we recorded this, I haven't written about it yet at all. And B, I've actually kind of promised myself that I'm going to watch it again before I do. So it's possible that by the time the dust settles, it might creep up to a 4, but right now I'm at a 3.5 just because I got this feeling that the film didn't let me in. Now, it could be that every 10 seconds my face was looking down at my notebook and making a note, and that's why the film didn't let me in, or it's possible that it's just a little cold, and that's what keeps it back from being a full masterpiece.
But it's possible it's the 26th film of the festival.
Yeah, of course, there is that. So now that I've recovered and I'm going to watch it with fresh eyes and no notebook, it's possible that it might be a 4 by the time I write about it. But right now, I'm with you. It's a 3.5. It's a really, really solid 3.5. If you've seen The Master, let us know what you think. Ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA. Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. I'd love to know what people think of The Master. I do think some people will not like it. I think some people, I know, some people absolutely love it. And I want to hear from you, so let me know. We're going to come right back after this. We're going to do the other side in just a moment. I gotta take it on the other side. Take it on the other side. Take it on. In trying to couple up films with Master, there's all kinds of choices, and Jandy, I must thank your kind of twisted sense of humor, because after watching 27 films in a week, there was nothing I wanted to do more than watch a 4-hour David Lean epic.
I told you it was an an inconvenient choice for a double feature.
It's quite all right. I've never been one to back down from a challenge, so I'll take it. So Jandy's choice to marry up with the Master, and we should state that in both of these choices, actually, we would never suggest actually watching these as a back-to-back double feature, because you'll just lose an entire day. Jandy chose Lawrence of Arabia, 1962, David Lean, and I want to ask you, because this is a film that's kind of come up in conversation as a little bit of a testy subject for some younger film fans. You genuinely like Lawrence of Arabia. It's not just that you respect it, but you love it, yeah?
No, yes, I love Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay, so what is it that you like about Lawrence?
For one thing, okay, I love desert cinematography, so that's kind of a given right there. But I also really like Lawrence because it's shot in an epic format, it's got an epic story, but at its heart, it's an intimate character study of this guy who no one really knows who he is, because he doesn't know who he is, and he doesn't, he's not able to express who he is to other people because he doesn't really know. And that's a really kind of radical thing to do in 1962, because, I mean, we're just coming off like Ben-Hur and all these other sword and sandal epics, and to do an epic that's actually a character study is ballsy. That's what actually connected it to the Master for me.
That's certainly what I've noticed over time, and you're right. It's what links it to the Master, because at its heart, it's a very, very human film. I was really smitten this time around when I watched it on very little sleep by those human moments. So, as a for instance, almost at the intermission point of this movie, and there is one if people haven't seen it, Lawrence returns to his headquarters, I believe it's in Cairo, but when he returns, because he's been traveling with the Arabs for months, he's dressed in robes. He has given over his military uniform, and he's now dressed like an Arab. So when he returns, first of all, it's a declaration of who he now thinks he is, because Omar Sharif's character, Ali, even challenges him. He says, when you return to headquarters, you're going to dress like a Westerner again. So it's a matter of pride, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, first of all, that I kind of latched onto. And then, again, almost, I think it's like just after the intermission, there's an execution that he has to carry out. And it's not something he wants to do. It's I think, like, if you watch this film, like, he's got tears in his eyes when he has to do it, but he realizes that in doing something like this, it's going to help the greater good. And it's those kind of moments in amongst these vast sweeping shots of desert and vast shots of battle that really make this movie.
Especially because of who he has to execute.
Yeah.
In that particular scene. I won't spoil it for people who haven't watched it, but that is a heartbreaking scene in the movie.
Yeah, it's given to us in such a way that, yeah, he comes into the scene and all we know is that one of the tribesmen has killed another, and the tribes are basically at risk of completely splintering. And so he steps in and he says, well, if I kill him, I have no tribe. Will that just end it? And they say yes. So we have no idea who they're talking about, just that it's a member of one tribe. And the reveal is heartbreaking is what it is. You're right. This, of course, is now, I think one of your choices on this is, like you said, the scale. And this is another film that uses 70mm. One of the moments I notice in The Master that really, really links up to Lawrence is they go out into what I can only imagine is like the Badlands in Utah or that kind of like area of the American Southwest, and they're riding around on this motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were riding around in that was where I really started thinking, well, shit, Lawrence of Arabia. Especially because at one point Freddie jumps on and like tears off. And because we're dealing with a 70mm print, we can see him for quite some time.
Yeah, it's very much like that one iconic scene in Lawrence of Arabia with them coming out of the desert, except he's going away from us.
Yeah, Yeah, they pull that trick. In Lawrence, they pull it twice, where somebody is coming towards us, but they start off as just like, you'd almost think it's like a scratch in the print, because it's just this tiny black dot well on the horizon. And if you're watching it on DVD or on your computer or even like in a 35 mil print, you might not see them for like 60 seconds, and then all of a sudden they appear. On a 70 mil print, you can actually see them grow and grow and grow in the shot. What else about Lawrence kind of made you think about the Master, or what else about the Master made you think of Lawrence?
It kind of leaves the character, both of them kind of leave the main character enigmatic, if you count Freddy as the main character. Sure. Of the Master. I mean, the Master kind of, I guess it helps Freddy a little bit, but not in any way completely or finally. Like, you don't feel like his journey is over.
No.
Or that he has got it all together now or has figured out his life. You feel like, you know, maybe this is one step and he's still working on it for a while. And there's one scene in Lords of the Arabia. I didn't actually rewatch it for this. I'm sorry.
Oh, you cheater!
I did rewatch Magnolia, though.
All right.
There's a scene, and it may be when you were talking about when he returns to Cairo, but he's dressed in his Bedouin robes and he walks over a mountain or a hill, a dune, and someone else sees him and says, "Who are you?" And he doesn't answer. And he's just, like, all you can see, his robes are hiding his face, so you can't see his face at all. And just, like, that scene, the fact that he doesn't answer, he doesn't know who he is, he doesn't know how to answer the question. Like, that, to me, I think, tied in a lot with Freddy, of he doesn't really know who he is either, or what to do to make his life what he wants it to be, if he even knows what he wants it to be.
Lawrence does play around a bit with faith too, because he's a Westerner. We would assume that he's, you know, he's probably Protestant or Anglican or some sort of you know, something of the like. He's dropped in amongst Arabs who are, you know, they have their own form of worship, and there's this kind of push and pull for his belief structure, much the same as there is with Freddy, of, you know, a new class of believers trying to get him to see the world their way.
Definitely. And I mean, there's a cultural thing too that goes along with, you know, being brought into a new religious situation.
And now the one thing I should say, and I think you could probably back me up on this, is as much as I do love Lawrence of Arabia, and as much as I would tell people to check it out if they never have, I also these days have been telling people, you know, if you live anywhere reasonably close, hold off until you can see it on a big screen, because it's really not the same if you watch it at home. I know we're in an age where people have like digital projectors and very large TVs, but it's really not the same experience if you're watching it at home.
Yeah, I've seen it both ways, and yeah. Definitely seeing it in a theater would be better.
So what would be, you know, as somebody who's a lover of the film, what would be your takeaway from Lawrence of Arabia if somebody was watching it for the first time, or like not quite like your souvenir, but what's the kind of the thing to appeal to somebody who is seeing it for the first time?
I don't know. I'd just sit back and enjoy the cinematography to start with. Mm. But I mean, it's a gorgeous looking film, and I think all the rest of it, it's not secondary to that, obviously, from what we've been talking about, but that's definitely an in for me on any film.
Yeah. So there we go. That's that's the longer of the two other sides for The Master. Mine is not a whole lot shorter, but we'll talk about it in just a moment right after this. For my companion piece to The Master, I went with the easy association. I went with another Paul Thomas Anderson film. I went back to 1999 and chose Magnolia. It is my favorite of his films, and unbeknownst to me, it is also Jandy's favorite. And it's a little bit divisive. I do know people who don't care for it. It's one of these, the same way that Lawrence of Arabia is a very sprawling, grand, epic story, this is also a very sprawling story, but it's a sprawling character piece. We're introduced to literally dozens of people who all have these intersections in their lives that sometimes we don't find out until very late. Sometimes we don't find them out unless you're paying close attention, but everything crosses at certain intersections and it all makes sense in the end. So you just mentioned that this is your favorite film of his by a healthy margin. What is it that you like about Magnolia more than the others?
Works for me.
Well, yeah, there's that.
I like the way that it builds all the different character stories together. And I was rewatching it this week, and that whole middle section, while it's raining,
oh yeah,
the rain section, it's built like a symphony, like all these different parts just coming in and like weaving in and out of each other. And it's just, by the time it builds to the end of that, it's like I'm breathless just how well all those pieces fit together emotionally. I was reading someone earlier today, or watching someone, oh, it was Matt Price, actually, was talking about how it had all these great scenes, but it didn't come together as a whole.
Oh,
and I can't agree with that, because I think it comes together as an emotional breakthrough and catharsis better than any of his other films for me.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel that the we'll talk about it in a second, but I feel that the moment that everything crosses, they all kind of find this same vertex where they all cross, is astounding. It's one of my very, very favorite films of the 90s, in a year that was stacked with really, really great films. And it's, which is funny, because it's just a story about people in Los Angeles on this one very crazy day. It is not what you'd call, it's not what you'd call like an exceptional story, strangely enough. It's one of these movies, again, kind of like The Master, where not a lot of plot really happens. We've got all these little, all these little things that happen in their own little pile, and then they cross all together, but it's not like something like Lawrence of Arabia, which is this great sprawling yarn of a story. Now, it's funny because I'm gonna run the spoiler flag up the flagpole right now, because we have to talk about the end of this movie. So if you haven't seen it, I think we would just both say just go check it out, and if you have seen it, listen up. The finale of this film, everything, all hell really starts to break loose when it starts raining frogs. And let us just pause to revel in the fact that there is a film out there that concludes with a storm of frogs. Did you see this in a theater?
No, I didn't. I saw it on DVD.
Okay.
I
was lucky enough to see it in a theater, and my jaw was on the floor when those things started coming down, because I don't know what I expected, where I expected it all to go. I certainly didn't expect that.
Well, there's no really way you would.
No. No, exactly. I've never seen something like that before. If I ever see something like that again, it will be like, well, it's ripping off Magnolia. But what it reminded me of when I rewatched it this week, and a few months ago, I rewatched Boogie Nights, and There Will Be Blood, and I rewatched Punch Drunk Love, is that one difference between Magnolia and The Master is, between all of his other films and The Master is, he doesn't do that stellar final act this time. His films really end on a bang of some sort, whether it's, you know, the fight that concludes There Will Be Blood, whether it's the argument in Punch Drunk Love and the whole thing, or whether it's just everybody's life just running out of control at the end of Boogie Nights. Magnolia is possibly the best of that, but that, I think, was one of those things that held The Master back for me, is that it doesn't have that grandiose Paul Thomas Anderson final act.
No, it just kind of fades away.
Yeah. So I think that was one of my, like, that, if I've got a flaw to pick in that, and especially, as I said, after watching the frogs and yeah, this sounds terrible, but enjoying the frogs as much as I do, that was one of those things where, in hindsight, I was like, oh, okay, there's something he didn't do this time. Another thing for me on this one that I noticed that plays differently now than it did when I saw it in 1999 is the part of Tom Cruise's role within this film as Frank T.J. Mackey.
Mm-hmm.
Is it my imagination, or does that part play differently knowing Tom Cruise the way we now know Tom Cruise?
Maybe a little bit. I can see why you'd say that.
Yeah. Like, to kind of put this into context for people, back when this film came out in 1999, Cruise was very, very much a Hollywood golden boy, even more so than he is now. He was doing stuff like Jerry Maguire. He was still doing Mission Impossible movies. He'd go on to do like Vanilla Sky. He was coming, that kind of thing. He was a very clean cut guy. And this was his first real shot, for lack of a better word, but this was his first real go at playing an absolute dick.
It was a real departure for him at the time.
Right, and that's the thing. Not to suggest that Tom Cruise is a dick, because I don't know the guy, but his behavior lately in public, and by lately I mean over the last 7 years, has leaned itself a lot more towards Frank T.J. Mackey than it did any of his other parts. So at the time, it was very shocking to hear him speak this way and see him play this part. But it's one of those things that I think if somebody were to watch it for the first time, wouldn't have that same effect.
Yeah, you could be right. It could be like, oh, yeah, Tom Cruise just doing that. As opposed to something, like, it doesn't feel like as much of a departure as it did at the time. I think you're right.
No, especially when he sits down with the woman for the interview. Like, that kind of feels like a lot of interviews I've actually seen him give. Was there anything else about the movie that kind of stuck out for you that, like, besides the obvious director connection that made it marry up to the master?
Well, they both had Philip Seymour Hoffman in them, like most of his movies.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Hoffman, like, there's another cool thing about rewatching Magnolia now is watching the evolution of Phil Seymour Hoffman, because that was right around the time he was really breaking through.
It's about the first thing I remember seeing him in, like, and knowing who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, and seeing like who he's become in the 13 years since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that is pretty cool. Well, if there's a takeaway for me for Magnolia, it's that it's a difficult story to tell, because it tells, as far as the major characters go, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9 like major stories to juggle, and they all connect in some way or another. And then you've got all these kind of secondary characters turning into all these coincidences and whatnot. And it's really, really a sign of a great story that can give you that many threads and make you feel fulfilled by all of them. Because I really don't think he shortchanges anybody in this story. You know, just to kind of end it on a happy note, the one thing I've always come back to in this film is the story of Claudia, the story of, she's the drug-using daughter of the game show host, who is, I think, one of the only characters, if not the only character, to just stand up and look at us on the screen and say, I am a damaged person. I don't know that I deserve to be happy. And she kind of speaks for, like, the crappiest moments that we feel amongst ourselves. But she has the, I don't know if it's the gumption or the gall or what it is, to say it out loud. And you feel for her almost more than anybody else in this movie, including the quiz kid. You feel for her because she has the honesty to say, I'm screwed up.
If I were doing a souvenir for this one, it would be that opening sequence.
Oh,
that used to not tie into anything, but then is actually like,
yeah,
the coincidences.
The 3 coincidences. It is a great way to open a movie. I don't think I've seen too many other movies that have opened it that way. The tale of Greenberry Hill, the blackjack dealer, who's played by Patton Oswalt, actually. you watch this movie after a few years and you start seeing people turn up. And of course, the 17-year-old Sidney Behringer, who goes to commit suicide and is unfortunately the victim of a successful homicide. Yeah, that is, along with that great conclusion, it's got that great beginning.
Yeah,
So, no, good call.
And they tie in together so well that when you get to the end, you're just like, oh, now I understand why that opening was the way it was.
Yeah. And it was funny because I do remember in the ads for this film, in the trailer for this film, one of the last things that's said out loud is, this will all make sense in the end. I really enjoyed going back to Magnolia, it had been a while since I rewatched it, but definitely one of my favorite movies. As I said, one of the very best of the 90s. I know there's some people out there who don't like it, but they're wrong. Exactly.
You don't understand.
I don't know. That is episode 68 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, October 8th for episode 69. That's the Thanksgiving episode, and we'll be discussing Looper. Jandy Stone Hardesty sometimes writes at The Frame and has getting back to writing at Row 3. You mentioned before something you've got coming up. What was it again?
Chuck Jones.
Right. Very cool. For
his 100th birthday. Published on Saturday, even though his birthday is tomorrow, because I have kind of a Saturday cartoon series that I'm trying to start back up.
Oh, okay. Well, this is going to go up on Monday, so look back a day or two and look for Jandy's post on Chuck Jones. And where can people find you on Twitter? I do know you're far more active there.
FaceX5, that's the numeral 5.
There you go. My site, of course, is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them anywhere fine podcasts are listed, including Blueberry, the iTunes Music Store, the iPhone podcasting app, and Listen for Android. They all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on The Master, on what you're thankful for, Lawrence of Arabia, or Magnolia can be left in the comments section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter, where I am matinee_CA, or Facebook, where it's facebook.com/darkmatinee. Jandy, any final thoughts before we close this sucker out?
Not really. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, I'm glad at least this time I could give you a heads up. As I said, I think last time I gave you something like 48 hours, maybe not even.
It was pretty close, yeah. But that's right.
So I was glad I could invite you proper, as it was. So for Jandy, I'm Ryan, and we'll see you at the matinee. Find me in the matinee, the dark of the matinee.